not only that we have experienced counsel, but counsel who do not believe that they need any kind of refreshing of their recollection of our procedures. In that event, we're ready to just go right ahead with the oral arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So you may proceed, Mr. Mullins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Steve Mullins, on behalf of Appellant Dale Ruff. I'd like to begin by indicating the relief that Mr. Ruff is requesting. We are requesting an order remanding in order to afford Mr. Ruff a full and fair hearing to establish a factual record in challenging the Dime report and opinion that was issued in this workers' compensation claim. And we respectfully submit that the standard for review in this case is de novo, because the error that we allege that was committed by the administrative law judge, Judge Friend, was an error of law. Claimant was, Mr. Ruff, was not allowed to create a factual record at time of hearing, and the issue, the underlying issue, or one of them, with regard to conflict of interest and the appearance of conflict on the part of the Division Independent Medical Examiner, Dr. Ashberger, is probably a mixed question of law and fact. Therefore, we submit that the standard, substantial evidence is not the standard for review, and the standard for review should be de novo based on an error of law.
Mr. Mullins, let me ask you about the case that was decided contrary to your position. I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Benucius.
Benucius?
Yes.
That case was decided correctly, then presumably there would be no need to remand anything. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. Benucius and Ruff are two entirely different cases. Well, they're not entirely different. They involve some of the same issues, some of the same legal contests, but they are not identical by any means. And in Ruff, there never was an opportunity afforded to Mr. Ruff to try his case and establish what was wrong with the Dime examiner, the Dime examination, and the Dime opinion based on the allegation of conflict and the appearance of conflict. More importantly,
ask you one question?
Certainly.
Wasn't it represented below that there was not a challenge to the actual result, that could not have been overcome? And so the only challenge was to the doctor's status?
No. The representation below that was in light of the judge's order. Judge Friend stated he would hear no argument, he would hear no evidence on the issue of conflict. And in light of that announcement by the court and that refusal by the court to allow an evidentiary record and to allow the challenge that we were prepared to make with significant additional and different evidence than occurred in Benucius, the claimant was simply precluded from having his day in court. So in this case, what the judge did was he decided, when we got to hearing on permanent disability, he decided to rely upon a decision that was made denying a request for protective relief, an interlocutory order, in order to deny claimant a hearing and evidence addressing the Division Independent Medical Exam and Examiner that was created as a matter of record after the exam took place. So you have the first order by Judge Kane denying interlocutory relief. You have a second order by Judge Friend, two entirely separate issues with, under the Sunny Acres case, much more at stake by the time we got to hearing on the issue of permanent disability, which was dispositive of the entire case. And what Judge Friend did was to acknowledge on the record that he had not read the transcript from Judge Kane's hearing, but he was going to simply announce that he was bound by the law of the case, which is how he termed it, when he commented upon Judge Kane's order. Well, Judge Kane's order was not entitled to law of the case treatment. Number one, it was interlocutory, and that interlocutory status, according to Colorado case law that appears to control, is not susceptible to treatment as law of the case. And number two, law of the case does not apply to factual questions. It applies to the resolution of decision of law. So,
counsel, let me follow up then.
Certainly.
If I could, on my colleagues, I think their train of thought, at least on
Judge
Taubman's. in order to remand on the conflict or the apparent conflict of interest issue, are we required to depart from the holding in the Benishus case?
No, you're not, for two reasons. Number one, Benishus did not deal with and did not reach the issue of pardon me, just one second.
Take as much time as you need, Mr. Mullins.
I'm sorry?
Take as much time as you need, Mr.
Thank
Mullins.
Thank you. Number one, Benishus did not address additional evidence that is contained in this case, and that would include the testimony that we were going to offer from the prior medical director at Pinnacle Assurance, who was prepared to testify that the procedures employed by the physicians serving as medical advisors like Dr. Ashberger were in fact not as found in Benishus to be neutral and simply helpful in deciding what medical treatment should or should not be approved, but that that medical treatment participation was a very small part of what the medical advisors did, and what the medical advisors have always done, do, and will continue to do is to assist in the preparation of defense of workers' compensation claims. That takes the medical advisor clearly out of the role as a neutral provider and a commenter on what's going to happen in terms of appropriate treatment. And that was a specific finding in Benishus. Secondly, in Benishus, there was no finding, if I can add just a second. I'm sorry. There was no finding, and the court did not reach the issue of quasi-judicial function. So that hasn't been resolved. And in fact, on certiorari, Justice Bender specifically announced that he would grant review on the issue of the role of the dime doctor in a quasi-judicial status, and therefore the entire issue and argument as to what the obligations are of the dime physician in terms of contractual relationship and disclosure, as well as disqualification. So no, the two cases are not identical, but I think more importantly, the claimant, Mr. Ruff, should be entitled to have a full evidentiary hearing. And instead of simply assuming without a factual record that the cases are going to be identical, I think as the Workers' Comp Act states, Mr. Ruff is entitled to have a full evidentiary hearing and a record on the challenge that he wishes to offer to the dime physician's opinion. It's his only chance to do this.
Mr. Mullins, yes. Am I correct in assuming that you believe that the Benishus case was not decided properly?
Yes, you are correct. I think that to expand on that a little bit, I think that the panel, and obviously this panel, is entitled to disagree with Benishus. I think the panel in Benishus made a decision that there was no way to understand what the phrase appearance of conflict meant, and therefore the panel in that case refused to consider obvious facts that I would hope this court would find to be very troublesome by way of appearance, including the fact that Dr. Ashberger, the dime doctor, earns 25% of his ordinary income serving as a Pinnacle SelectNet doctor and a Pinnacle medical advisor, the fact that he never disclosed his contractual relationship, the fact that Pinnacle was aware that this dime doctor had this alleged conflict and they never disclosed, the fact that all three doctors on the Division Independent Medical Examination panel were in fact contracted with Pinnacle as Pinnacle SelectNet physicians, and nobody ever said boo about this the entire time.
Mr. Mullins, let me ask you two hypothetical questions.
Yes, sir.
Number one, if Dr. Ashberger had only one contract with Pinnacle and received, let's say, $1,000, would that create the appearance of conflict that would require his disqualification, in your view?
In my view, if the contract and the performance under that contract occurred simultaneous with his assignment as a dime doctor and his performance of the exam in this case, it is my belief, consistent with the director's Rule 11, that the doctor was obligated to report the potential conflict. Whether it would have constituted a conflict then should have been up to the director, and that would have been an action that would have been factually driven. But, Your Honor, that bears no relationship or resemblance to what occurred in this case, in this case.
I understand that. That's why I'm asking hypothetical questions in order to try and elucidate your position more clearly. My second hypothetical is, what if Dr. Ashberger received 90% of his income from Pinnacle? Would that require his that he not participate?
I think your point is excellent. I think under the Benoitius decision, Dr. Ashberger would not have been disqualified if he was married to the adjuster at Pinnacle, would not have been disqualified if 100% of his income came from working under contracts that he had with Pinnacle Assurance, and there would be no basis to disqualify Dr. Ashberger unless, as the Benoitius panel held, there was some relationship between Dr. Ashberger and the treating physician, which begs the final question. Is it possible the conflict of interest can only affect the interests or concerns of one party? Is it not a fact and a clearly recognized legal doctrine that conflict of interest in fact and the appearance of conflict apply to both parties equally in order to assure fairness in legal process? I guess I've answered your question.
Okay. Mr. Mullins, is there a specific test that ought to be used to determine an appearance of conflict of interest? That phrase is used by both parties throughout the briefs, but I didn't see any reference to any cases or any code of ethics or anything else that would suggest how a court ought to apply that phrase.
The American Medical Association has promulgated a series of ethical position papers that actually are part of this record. And under those ethical provisions authored by the American Medical Association, the same group that promulgates the guides to the evaluation of impairment that's included in the COMP statute, this conduct clearly is prohibited. And there's an absolute obligation on the part of the assigned doctor to disclose facts that give rise to an actual conflict or the appearance of conflict. I also suggested, I believe in the initial brief, that if a reasonable man, hearing the facts of the case, would have cause to pause, consider, or ask questions about the relationship between the physician and the insurance carrier, or the physician and the claimant, either party in this case, then there would be at least the potential for appearance of conflict that should be addressed.
So is your position that Rule 11-2H is just a part of the analysis, not the entire analysis?
Yes, and I make that suggestion for the very reason that the director, Whiteside, enacted that rule. She said specifically, including but not limited to, and that's right in the middle of Rule 11. So it's very clear that contrary to the Benoitius panel decision, the director who promulgated that rule had in mind that the examples given in the rule were not exclusive, and that it was to cover all types of conduct that could call into question, first and foremost, financial relationships that always give rise to questions as to conflict or appearance of conflict. May I reserve the last 2 minutes?
Yes, you may.
Thank
Certainly.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, and I represent the respondents, City of Manassa and Pinnacle Assurance. We're requesting that you affirm the decision of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office below. I'll start off by discussing the decision by ALJ Fred in the second hearing not to hear the issue of conflict of interest or Dr. Ashberger's status as the Division IME physician. Contrary to statements of counsel, I don't believe Judge Friend mentioned the doctrine of law in the case on the record. It was a very short hearing that's in the second hearing, and it was more geared towards the fact that when Mr. Mullins raised the issues at the beginning of the hearing, mentioning that he was attempting to overcome the Division IME by clear and convincing evidence and strike the Division IME report on the basis of conflict. It was then raised by counsel for the respondents at that time that this was matter had been previously decided by Judge Friend when Judge, I'm sorry, by Judge Kane. When Judge Friend then indicated that he was bound by Judge Kane's prior decision on the issue of Dr. Ashberger's status as a dying physician, Mr. Mullen stated in that case he essentially conceded that he was unable to overcome the opinion of Division IME on the issue of the permanent disability, which essentially was the remaining issue. Mr. Mullins did not make any offer of proof with regard to the evidence that he says was precluded. So error cannot be predicated on the lack of evidence when there was no indication. For example, as he was, as he stated earlier today, he was going to present the testimony of a prior medical advisor for Pinnacle Assurance regarding the role of a medical advisor. That was not mentioned on the record before ALJ Friend, that that's the sort of evidence that he was attempting to elicit. Also, Mr. Mullins mentions the Sunny Acres case, which deals with issue preclusion and essentially allows a party to relitigate an issue when they don't have the same incentive as they previously did. There was no mention of Sunny Acres or the claimant's incentive to relitigate the issue of Dr. Ashberger's status at the second hearing. There was nothing on the record with regard to that. But the only thing on the record was the statement by Mr. Mullins to Judge Friend that the issues were different, but there was no attempt to invoke the law set forth in the Sunny Acres case.
Mr. Flewelling, I assume that you believe that the Benutius case was correctly decided. Is that correct?
Yes. On the issue of standard of review, for example, the Benutius court first set forth that it's a question of fact for the ALJ to determine whether there was an actual or apparent conflict of interest, and it was only the administrative law judge's interpretation of the statute or the regulation governing conflicts which is subject to the de novo review, and that's the way they analyze the case, first interpreting Rule 11-2H, which is the only rule that there is no statute that specifically addresses conflict of interest, only the Rule 11-2H, and they interpreted that as being limited limiting the appearance of conflict of interest to when there are relationships between the treating doctors and the Division IME physician. And
let me follow up on and ask you a question similar to what I asked Mr. Mullins. Let's assume as a hypothetical that Dr. Ashberger received 90% of his income from Pinnacle. Do you think that that would be a situation that where there would be an appearance of a conflict of interest under the regulation?
If we're talking about whether the regulation per se requires that a finding of appearance be made, no. As the Benutius court said, the regulation in and of itself does not prevent a physician who has a contract with the insurance company or even acts as a medical advisor from performing a Division IME.
So is it your position then that regardless of the percentage of income that any doctor would receive from Pinnacle, that would not be sufficient to create an appearance of conflict?
My position, that's not exactly my position, because I believe it's a question of fact for the ALJ. Well, I think the ALJ has to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether there's an appearance.
Then let me ask you the same question of a different question that I asked Mr. Mullins. What is the standard then that a court ought to use or that an ALJ should use to determine whether there is an appearance of a conflict? If your position is that there could be some situation where an ALJ could find as a factual matter that there is an appearance of conflict, then are there any criteria that the ALJ ought to use to make that determination?
Well, the ALJ, ALJ Kane in the first, in his first order, or the first order in this case, following the first hearing, actually did consider or applied the standard that the claimant failed to prove that a reasonable person, knowing all the facts, would harbor substantial doubts about Dr. Ashberger's ability to impartially perform the division IME.
So are you saying that that's a standard that ought to be used by an ALJ?
Yes, I agree with the standard that Judge Kane applied here, looking at the totality of the circumstances and applying that standard. Judge Kane determined that the claimant failed to prove Dr. Ashberger had an actual or appearance of conflict of interest.
Counsel, okay. Let me piggyback on that if I could. Sorry, Judge Tubman.
Go ahead.
So if there's two cases and an ALJ makes a fact determination in case one that 90% of the work is not an apparent conflict of interest, and in case two, a different ALJ decides that 10% of the work is a conflict of interest, are they both right?
If they're stating as a matter of law?
Well, you said that it's a question of fact, determination.
I think they both could be right, Your Honor, depending on the totality of the circumstances. If, for example, actually in the Benoist's case compared to this one, we're not talking about a very large difference in the amount of business these physicians performed in which they earned income from Pinnacle Assurance. But the other evidence, which was unrebutted, was that these doctors, number one, their contracts are not dependent or conditional upon rendering favorable decisions to Pinnacle. In both cases, the doctors said that they would render honest opinions without regard to the relationship with Pinnacle and so forth. It's the totality of the circumstances. It's not just the factor of the percentage of income derived from Pinnacle Assurance. Pinnacle insures more than half of the employers in Colorado. So nearly every doctor who looks at injured workers in Colorado probably at one time or the other is going to be billing Pinnacle Assurance. I'm not sure if there's anybody who makes 90% of their income, but most workers' compensation physicians are going to end up having some income from Pinnacle Assurance. And under Senate Bill 218 from 1991, workers' compensation insurers are required to have a managed care network in many counties of Colorado. And the SelectNet network essentially was created and continues to be something that is geared towards complying with that law and assuring that the injured workers receive quality care from physicians who are qualified in occupational health.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. So do you agree that Benoist pretty much stands for that that Rule 11-2H delimits pretty much what a conflict is, even though it says included but not limited to, it's of the kind of whether there's a relationship with the treating doctor and with the claimant? Do you agree that that's what Benoist stands for?
Yes. Essentially, Rule 11-2H does not in and of itself prevent physicians who have contracts with insurance carriers or act as network providers or medical advisors for performing division IMEs. So in and of itself, it clearly does not preclude that involvement. And number two, the examples shown for appearance or actual conflict of interest are limited to relationships between the Division IME doctors and treating physicians, and whether there are direct financial interests involved in that.
So is it your position that it's not so limited? When you're saying it's the totality of the circumstances, it can include relationships other than that with the claimant or treating physicians of the claimant?
I think the holding, are you asking about whether the holding is limited?
No, I'm asking your position on it.
My position is we agree with the holding in Benoitius that the rule is limited, the examples in the rule are limited to relationships between physicians.
Okay, and beyond the rule, can there be other conflicts of interest or appearances of conflicts of interest other than what stated?
Yes, well, we agree that beyond the rule, there could be actual conflicts of interest. But in this case, the findings of the judge, supported by the evidence, are that there was no actual or apparent conflict of interest. Dr. Ashberger's testimony, there was testimony from some employees from Pinnacle Assurance regarding the Select Network, support the finding of Judge Kane that there was no actual or apparent conflict of interest, that payment for services are not conditioned upon him rendering favorable opinions to Pinnacle. No one from Pinnacle ever contacted him in any claim in an effort to influence his opinions. which brings up a point. In claimant's briefs, there were several mentions made of ex parte communications with Division IME physicians. But Rule 11 does not prohibit ex parte communications in general. It simply prohibits such communications in regard to that specific claim. So there's no prohibition for Pinnacle Assurance communicating with a physician who happens to be a dime physician on another claim. There's no prohibition on that at all.
Mr. Fluong, does the record in this case indicate how many Pinnacle Select Neck physicians there are in the state of Colorado?
Well, the record, I think it might even be a finding by the judge that there are 2,800, and I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but that's what the finding was.
And how about with respect to Pinnacle physician advisors?
I don't believe the record specifically states how many there are. I think, actually, in Mr. Mullins' brief, I believe he makes a statement on the number, and I'm not sure if that's in the record or not. There was no reference to the record where it was stated in Mr. Mullins' brief.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to whether the relationship between the physicians and Pinnacle must be disclosed, that's a red herring. That's not relevant to the inquiry because it was found there was no actual or apparent conflict of interest. The Industrial Claim Appeals Office rejected that for that reason as well, if there's no actual or apparent conflict, how can you disclose something that doesn't exist? No further questions. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fluong.
May it please the Court. It would seem that the most fundamental rule with regard to determining conflict or the appearance of conflict is that you don't let the person who benefits from the alleged conflict testify that they have no conflict, and that there has to be objectivity in determining whether someone is tainted either with conflict in fact or the appearance of conflict, and there should be an objective standard. And we respectfully submit that that objective standard, first and foremost, is conditioned upon the existence of a financial relationship between the person, in this case the doctor, who serves in a quasi-judicial capacity and essentially makes the decision that ends the case, and the insurance company. And we respectfully submit that if this is a quasi-judicial function, which we allege it is, because the doctor's decision is entitled to protection in terms of evidentiary burden and can only be overcome by clear and convincing evidence, number one. Number two, the dime doctor is protected from any liability under the statute, similar to the status enjoyed by judges. And number three, most important, these dime doctors perform a function that prior to 1991 was always performed by administrative law judges. They determine what the permanent impairment is and whether the claimant has reached MMI. I would like to note for the record that the at page record page 422, lines 18 through 20, claimant specifically made an offer of proof as allowed, and as to the fact that there were different issues implicating the case already mentioned about the importance of the two separate hearings, at page 421, line 3 and 4, and page 420, line 10 through 15, there was an effort on the part of claimant to indicate to Judge Friend that the hearing for protective relief was entirely different than the issue on the final hearing for permanent impairment. I would submit to the court that the issue of conflict of interest must never be the subject of what is effectively a personality contest where the judge gets to decide which witness they like more or which witness they think they believe more. Objective criteria has to be employed. From the court's questions, I would...
Excuse me, Mr. Mullins, your time is up.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your presentation this afternoon. Mr. Flewelling, thank you as well. We appreciate both of your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the arguments for Division 1 this afternoon, and the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.